Hi, and welcome to the second episode of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Cardiff Garcia. I've been an economics podcaster for many years at places like the Financial Times, NPR, and now at Bizarre Audio. And I'm delighted to be here as co-host for this episode of Onward. And the other co-host, of course, is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, hey.
Cardiff, it's excellent to have you on board here.
I think people are going to really enjoy today's episode. So we are going to be discussing the events in Ukraine and the fallout, the economic sanctions on Russia and its effects on the rest of the global economy. And we're going to be talking about scenario planning, how you plan for the future when the future is as uncertain as it is now. But first, Ben, I just kind of want to ask you to characterize how you see the U.S. economy right now, because it seems like it's full of contradictions. On the one hand, you have a very strong labor market, lots of jobs being created, a lot of job openings that are available. But of course, you've got very high inflation. Energy prices are still rising, mortgage rates are rising, and all that seems like it would weigh on the economy. So as somebody who actually looks at these variables with an eye towards making decisions based on them, how would you characterize the environment we're in?
You know, Cardiff, we prepared for this episode, and the question we most frequently got from our investors was, how are interest rates and inflation going to affect real estate? So we wanted to do a episode on inflation. Going into that episode, U.S. GDP, highest been in maybe 40 years. Inflation is high, but it's high because of strength. There's just a lot of demand, and that's causing most of the issues. Demand for labor, demand for goods, and the pandemic looks like is receding, and that's going to cause a lot of growth, a lot of benefits.
And maybe the economy would start to return to normal over time.
Yeah, I think there was a good chance, although I was uncertain about this, as everybody, good chance that we could work our way through this supply chain disruption. But when we walk through our scenario planning, we have a structured way we think about it. And one of those points is always to say, okay, but what's something uncertain? What's something that's, you know, unknown that could happen? And actually, internally, we'd say, what if Russia invades Ukraine? And that turned out to pass is the sort of the thing no one was expecting happened. And it changed the game. And that's, you know, in a way, that's always what happens.
Would you say that this is as confusing an economic period of time as we've had, at least for you as an executive who really does, you know, follow the economy to try to make decisions based on where the trends are headed? Do you think this is as confusing or contradictory a time as you've seen in your time as CEO of Fundrise and as somebody who makes these kinds of decisions?
It's like March 2020. Because March 2020, you had two opposite dynamics happening at the same time, right? You had a horrible pandemic and no one knew at the time how bad the virus would be. And then you had this massive amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus, trillions pouring in. And so, you know, which would actually basically overcome the other, at least economically. And that was uncertain in March 2020. And so here we are again with a similar situation, a lot of strength in the economy. And then you have the brink of global war, potentially, right, where there's a real risk of escalation in Ukraine. And in some ways, that's actually a bigger risk than the pandemic was, but it hopefully a lower likelihood. One of the biggest challenges is something we talk about a lot internally in terms of management. This is a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald, something like, first-rate intellect can hold two opposing thoughts in their mind and still function. Mm-hmm. And so you have two opposing ideas, right? It could be the absolutely strong, great time in the economy, and it could be complete catastrophe. Both are possible, both are arguably likely. You can't know, and so you have to basically operate in this sort of tension. And that a lot of times our junior team members would be like, well, but which is it though?
Right. Somebody will want that certainty. I think a lot of us gravitate towards that certainty, but that can be dangerous, right? When you really want to know definitively what's happening and you want an answer in an environment where you can't really give that kind of definitive answer, you really have to be prepared for anything. And I guess when I describe the current environment, very confusing and full of contradictions, I think that's what I mean, is that you actually have to be very careful to be open-minded about what could end up happening, because if not, you really end up risking making some big mistakes if you want to base the decisions you make on a level of certainty that is just totally unjustified.
And actually, that's why we do this sort of structured scenario planning, is it forces you out of your comfort zone. And the comfort zone is a place of tomorrow is likely to be the same as today. And that's the assumptions our brain makes. You know, arguably, there is no certainty, even when things don't seem, you know, unstable. Like on September 10th, 2001, there wasn't a lot of uncertainty in the market.
Yeah.
And then the next day, right? So that level of certainty is always an illusion, especially I think the stock market, you look at a lot of the public markets, they love to live in this place where there's like the limited uncertainty in the market. And this is like the Nassim Taleb's critique of the markets. It's like the short-term memory is dominant over the long-term memory.
Yeah. And you had communicated to me before today's show, Ben, that you thought it was really important when talking about what's happening in Ukraine to first just acknowledge the tragedy that it is, especially for the people who are actually living through it. And I think it's been also just quite moving, quite affecting for people who are following these events throughout the world. And it is also going to have some meaningful economic consequences for the world. And we've kind of seen that already with the imposition of these sanctions on Russia by the US, by Europe, by the UK. Do you want to just kind of share your broad thoughts on these events in Ukraine and how you're sort of following them? And yeah, what do you think?
You know, for everybody, it's a very personal event and it's horrific. And it has been really moving to see a lot of the world come together. Problem with analyzing Ukraine and invasion is that's not our expertise, not my expertise. So I can only speak to it from a limited perspective. But in terms of how it affects the economy, I mean, at this moment, we have $1 billion of financing and acquisitions going on. And so whatever we're doing expresses our point of view. In action would also be an expression of the outcomes we think are likely. So if I were to try to put a simplistic frame onto it, actually, it does fit into the sort of structured scenario planning that we use generally. The framework we use is by Peter Schwartz. He wrote this book called The Art of the Long View. And it's all about trying to help people make better decisions because a lot of decisions around how people think about the future are biases that, you know, Kahneman and Tversky talk about. And so by being more structured, you can actually basically do better. And so his framework basically is you have three scenarios. One is a linear projection of the present, so more of the same. And that scenario basically presumes that the present is stable into the future.
So basically, this is extrapolating from what you've already been experiencing and assuming that there will be some continuity there. Okay.
Exactly. Natural extrapolation.
Right.
That's basically kind of where most people will go. There is a naturally extrapolate the present into the future.
Yeah, that's the sort of default behavioral setting. And let me just recapitulate something you said,
yes,
because you alluded to the work of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. These are very famous behavioral economists who, in Danny Kahneman's case, because he was still alive when it was awarded, won the Nobel Prize in economics for this work. But what you're saying is that based on what we know of how people think of internal psychology, that most people default to this kind of status quo bias that most people take from what they've experienced and they kind of project that out into the future. And so when you think about the different scenarios that you're contemplating as part of this framework that you use of scenario planning, you start with that one because that is the one that most people are going to assume. And because that one, I guess it might be the easiest to consider. You just say, hey, this is what's been happening. Maybe this is what will keep happening. So you start with that. Is that right?
Right. By making that a scenario, then you can kind of say, okay, well, that's one possibility rather than the possibility. And why it ends up being usually an optimistic scenario is in most cases, the idea that the present is stable is an optimistic view.
Yeah. And it assumes that bad things throughout the world won't knock it off its trajectory.
Yeah. Or it could be good things, but it's often bad things. And then scenario two is that if something bad happens. And so the stability isn't persistent. Something collapses it. And then the scenario three is that something unexpected happens, something that you couldn't imagine happening happens. And that's like the pandemic. In 2019, people weren't saying, what if there's a pandemic?
Yeah. And so when you think about these three different kinds of potential future scenarios as part of this framework, why don't we talk about what they look like in detail? So let's start with scenario one, which is this kind of more of the same scenario. What does that look like in practice to you? What assumptions do you make when you sort of try to put together what that scenario looks like and how that would affect the decisions that you make at Fundrise?
Scenario one, this present persists, is that the ground war in Ukraine between Russia continues on for months and years in a grinding sort of state of despair. And that's like an Afghanistan type scenario, if you will. And so scenario two is it deteriorates and gets much worse. And that could be nuclear or biological.
An even bigger catastrophe than the one we've already had, like orders of magnitude right. bigger. Yeah.
And then scenario three is that something unexpected happens. And so people would say, well, what if like Putin's overthrown? But that's not really unexpected. I'm not sure.
Yeah, people are already assigning probabilities to that. Maybe not huge ones, but they are assigning some probability to that.
So
sure.
So then that would be well.
Depends on your point of view.
I don't really know how exactly if that ends up being a good thing, but there are versions of that where it's a good thing, but then it could be like something happens. China invades Taiwan or something totally unexpected. And all of a sudden, everything, all the scenarios change. So anyways, the point is it helps you think about what you'd be doing. Under each scenario, you say, okay, well, is this a good decision? If I do this, if one of these three things happen, and if it isn't, what would I change to prepare? So you move that to the original aim, which was to try to think about how a high inflation environment will transform the real estate market and the broader economy.
Yeah, we're still in scenario one here, by the way, right? This is essentially a continuation of the status quo in which the high inflation rates that we are seeing now, with inflation at its highest point in four decades, and that would continue under this scenario. What else would this world look like, a sort of extended present scenario?
Well, I think a lot of times with scenario one, which is an extrapolation of the present, it includes like some optimism, but like a reasonable optimism. So you'd say like, okay, the Fed is able to tame inflation to some extent in the sort of scenario one, instead of inflation being what was, 3 weeks ago when we were thinking, when we were writing this draft, 6%, or now it's 7, going on 8. The stock market and all their analysts were literally saying it would go to 4 by the end of the year. It would moderate. It would step down, sort of natural steps. It'd be like, again, linear, very incremental in the way it would play out. And as inflation moderates, that basically allows supply chains to get fixed. It would make competition for labor a little bit less intense. And the stock market may correct 15% or something like that, but won't collapse. And basically, it's a soft landing. And that's essentially scenario one is what the Federal Reserve kind of like is hoping to see happen.
Yeah.
It's just a question, do you think hope will triumph over experience?
Yeah, there's an interesting complicating factor here for scenario one, more of the same. Because in just the last 3 years, the stuff that you could define as, well, this is the normal thing that I'm experiencing has changed so much. So if to you, the normal thing to experience is the world as it was in 2019, when inflation was very low, unemployment was very low as well, the economy was growing kind of slowly, kind of sluggishly still in the aftermath of the huge financial crisis of 2008, 2009. Well, for 10 years, you had been experiencing this kind of grinding, gradually declining unemployment, very low inflation, until bam, the pandemic hits in 2020. Then you think, well, things are going to be horrible for a few months, and they were quite terrible. And certainly, in terms of the health response and health outcomes, they have continued to be quite horrific. But from an economic standpoint, the recovery has been way more impressive than a lot of people, I think, expected because of the response of policymakers. But you also ended up getting fast growth and very high inflation. Now, there's the potential effects of what's happening with Ukraine and Russia and in geopolitics generally, which seems like it might exacerbate some of the worst things we saw, like the snarling of the supply chains and the high inflation rates. So you almost have three different scenarios. And I guess my question would be, like, which of those would you pick to think of as like the extrapolation from the present scenario one? Because you have a few options, right?
The natural inclination is to extrapolate the present into the future. But we saw the way that the 10-year run in the 2010s was with an unnatural break, with a nonlinear, unexpected change. But everybody expected it to change incrementally, and that would be a natural ending to that cycle. And so the lesson is that usually it's a nonlinear break. Organic complex systems, they always operate nonlinearly. We think of them as linear, but that's actually how school teaches you to look at most systems, like solar systems are actually stationary processes. They operate linearly, but markets and anything organic doesn't. So we have this bad training and a bad natural bias. So it's not an accident that we see this repeated mistake.
We keep being surprised, right?
By groups, yeah, by can't help ourselves. So I think of it as a more of a question. The question that we don't know the answer to, is inflation harder to tame than the market is fragile to break? It's really like the Fed's going to increase interest rates. They may pull liquidity out of the system by quantitative tightening, whatever you want to call it. And that is meant to tame inflation. And the question is, how strong is the economy? How strong are the financial markets? Because if they're strong, they can remove these sort of supports from the economy and inflation should be tamed. And if the financial markets are actually fragile, if the 10 years of quantitative easing and Fed monetary policy has been masking weakness and masking problems, basically, in the economy, if they remove it, then the system will collapse. And so that's the lesson from 2008, right? Is that the plumbing matters, that like the stuff underneath of the market that ultimately bankrupted Lehman Brothers is actually like critical. And we just don't know. So that's the question.
This is actually quite an interesting tangent to go on, because when we're talking about the financial plumbing, well, just like regular plumbing, it's often hard to see. It's quite opaque. And so the ways in which it might break can also be a little bit hard to see. But I also think it's worth restating what you just said, this idea that when the Federal Reserve removes some of the policy that it had in place before to help boost the economy and to keep it growing, if it removes some of that policy with the aim of lowering inflation, well, is it going to end up breaking something else? Will it lead to some other kind of consequences in financial markets that are just very hard to see in advance, precisely because these things are just hard to anticipate? And so a sort of return to the normal of like lower inflation might be the aim of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, and of policymakers generally, but it does risk having these other consequences that you just described.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Let's do scenario two then. What's the unstable situation? What is the sort of calamitous scenario, which is usually scenario two, the collapse essentially?
Right. So scenario two is an unstable situation that becomes more unstable. So that basically looks like a deep recession, and it could be from higher inflation that you can't, the Federal Reserve can't tame. Financial markets basically end up being fragile and collapse. The war in Ukraine escalates, and even another mutation of the coronavirus comes and we have another wave of the pandemic. So all of the things, or some combination of those things, could cause the U.S. economy to go into decline.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize here, that is not just an extrapolation from the present, even though we've seen those things. It is essentially an exacerbation of all those trends, making things much worse and leading to some really bad outcomes. It is an intensification of some of the terrible things that we have already seen, right?
When you look at the financial markets, we actually haven't seen how resilient they really are to higher interest rates and quantitative tightening. And so if you see stock market collapse and even some banks start to fail, that's the kind of thing that would be a surprise to people, that their banking sector is not strong, or something in the corporate sector, something in it, when you reveal the actual underlying plumbing. And once the tide goes out, you can kind of see what's underneath of the pier. That's a question we don't know the answer to. The Federal Reserve's put so much money, trillions, into this financial sector, and we don't know if it's healed since 2008 or if essentially it's actually still broken underneath the hood.
Yeah, and in terms of Fundrise's business and real estate in general, does real estate collapse along with everything else in this scenario?
So it depends. If you own good real estate with low leverage, it's one of those things that's much more stable and has been resilient over the decades. Now, if you overlever and you're in bad real estate, yes, you can make bad decisions. You saw that in 2007 and 8. We also saw a huge comeback if you had the right real estate. So it's a lot of it's in the execution, not just in the theory. So just parse basically what's happened to date, right? So we got inflation because first there was extremely liberal monetary policy. Not only was there zero interest rate policy for about 10 years, 12 years maybe, and $9 trillion or $8 or $9 trillion quantitative easing money printed into the economy. That's like the first part. A massive wealth effect that came from that. Huge asset inflation. So no, quote, no inflation, but asset prices went up hundreds of percent. So
the concept of the wealth effect, though, we should explain it. This is essentially when things like stock prices go up or house prices go up, people feel wealthier. And on paper, at least, they are wealthier. And so they're more comfortable spending money, and that helps boost the economy. So that's part of how it works, right?
Especially in 2020 and 2021, something trillions of dollars went straight into the economy, checks, lots of spending. And that was very different than the kind of reaction we saw in 2008. Massive demand pull. So there's a lot of demand for goods, especially coming out of the pandemic. People have saved a lot of extra money, and that drove a lot more demand for goods and now services. We have cost push, which basically means there's the cost of goods is going up. And that's usually because the input prices from commodities are going up and labor costs or wages are going up. There's a shortage of labor, right? So there's this question about, will this shortage of labor that's causing wages to go up work itself out and more workers will come into the workforce? So there's like real questions about that. And lastly, sentiment around inflation starting to become, oh, there's never going to be inflation again, to be like, well, inflation is here to stay. One of the ways we're seeing that in a typical real estate contract, let's say you sign a 10-year lease with an industrial tenant or office tenant, you used to have a fixed CPI or consumer price index increase to recognize inflation. So it'd be a fixed increase of somewhere between 1.5% to 3% a year would be the institutional expectation of inflation. And now we're seeing 4%, 4.5%, a lot of negotiation on that. And that's for contract we've signed today for 10 years. So you're starting to see that kind of expectation for inflation get baked into sentiment.
So then to draw that connection really clearly, the idea here is that when higher expectations for inflation are baked in, that can lead to actually higher inflation in the present because it's expected. And so companies might start raising their prices in anticipation of higher inflation in the future, basically.
There's a big debate in the economic circle of whether or not inflation is primarily a psychological phenomenon. And there's another argument that says it's a monetary phenomenon. It's from printing money. And we printed trillions in 2008 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 12, didn't see inflation. That was confusing to a lot of people who thought that inflation was a monetary phenomenon. So, but the point is, if you think about what drives inflation, we just had everything that drives inflation. Every box was checked. So when you talk about, okay, what does it take to tame inflation? It's not going to be that easy because it's not localized. It's really across virtually every major driver of inflation. When you're starting to think about, okay, how strong is inflation? How hard is it going to be to tame? Versus how strong is the market and which one's stronger? You're looking at a situation where inflation is, I believe, fairly strong, will be difficult to tame.
Like broad base, like it's all throughout the economy. Yeah.
Exactly.
Although I will point out that it is everywhere, but it is still the case, and this might be a more of a hopeful take, that the sectors that have been most directly affected by the pandemic are still the ones that have seen the highest inflation rates. And so under one of these scenarios where things start to revert back to what they were like before, kind of back in scenario one here, there is a chance, for example, if people start spending less money relatively on goods again, which makes it easier for supply chains to unsnarl, that you'll have a lot less inflation in those parts of the economy. And it'll go back into services, which before, right, had inflation rates that also weren't climbing that much, right? So it is possible that some normalization here will lead to less inflation. But that is kind of the hopeful take. And we are in scenario two right
now. We're in scenario two. So let's talk about why.
Which is the not hopeful take. So please continue. Yeah. So very high inflation and it's everywhere and it's broad based.
Yeah. Sure. But I'm glad I appreciate the sort of the counter position because I have a natural inclination towards the skeptical. And every investment we make and every business plan, I'm just thinking about scenario two. The team makes fun of how paranoid I am. So. Okay, so now basically, if you're starting to think about scenario two, the Fed has to unwind what just happened over the last decade plus. So they have to basically start by tightening the monetary policy, raising interest rates, and maybe selling down some of their liquidity. That should have the opposite of a wealth effect, right? Stock market comes down, people don't feel as wealthy, people don't spend as much, and that starts to like lower demand for goods and maybe also quell positive sentiment. If you can lower demand for things, then there's less tension, pressure on the supply chain, which gives them more room to start to fix it. And that if you have, less demand, you also have less demand for labor. So less competition for labor. So then there's less wage push.
Wage growth is not climbing as quickly as it had been.
Yeah. Right? And then people start feeling like things cooling down and they start feeling like inflation is likely to be tamed and sentiment starts to get better. That's the plan. So what do we skip? So what are the flaws in that? So we skipped fiscal stimulus. So if you wanted to do the perfect execution, you'd run a budget surplus. Rather than running deficits, which basically stimulate the economy, you'd want to run a budget surplus, which basically would pay down the debt and take some money out of the economy so that later you can use it to stimulate during a downturn. That doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Instead, we're going to run, the projections are $1 trillion a year in deficits. And $1 trillion is about 5% of GDP. So you're talking about 5% stimulus of GDP a year. So there's still fiscal stimulus coming into the economy. And that we saw that in particular, like, for example, with the infrastructure bill, right?
Yeah. I mean, fiscal stimulus was huge in 2020 and last year. I think the added impulse that it gives to the economy is set to fall, actually, this year, so that it actually is going to start to fall.
Less fiscal stimulus, but we're still stimulating the economy.
Oh, sure. Well, we're still running deficits, for sure.
Still running deficits. So you're trying to tame inflation while you're still actually, on net, stimulating the economy. You're still running deficits.
Let me see if I can summarize some of what's happening in scenario two here. So one is that the war in Ukraine itself has a kind of calamitous outcome, whatever that might look like, even more horrific than what's already been happening. Another is that the U.S. continues to suffer from very high inflation. That might drive up interest rates. That might collapse growth in the economy. And it leads to potentially a recession and maybe even a kind of protracted recession. And so a lot of things that are happening in the economy just full stop start to fall apart, right? People start losing jobs again, that kind of thing. And on top of it, some of the high deficits that the U.S. economy has run in the last few years end up becoming an actual problem for the U.S. government to sell its debt, which keeps interest rates high because now investors start to get nervous. So does scenario two more or less look like that? That is the sort of bad downward economic trend.
Go into recession because all those things. One more possible is that there's another mutation and the pandemic comes back again. Essentially, the financial system and the economy collapses under the efforts to try to tame inflation and also war, pandemics, and other kinds of shocks to the system. So that scenario two, it's not actually that hard to imagine. I would say in some ways, maybe it's easier to imagine than an optimistic scenario, at least for me. And so you now are saying, okay, I have to be ready for those two new scenarios. And then I have to be ready for a third, too, which is the unexpected.
Okay. This one has to be the hardest one to actually define because by definition, it's something that you can't quite anticipate. So how do you handle scenario three? How do you go about thinking through a scenario three?
Yeah, it's definitely the hardest. It's actually closest to what the sort of Nassim Taleb's concept of a black swan. I feel like the way that people use black swan in like conversation, it means like some dark event descending on everything and just blowing everything up. But I really think what he meant by that was that you thought all swans in the world were white.
Right.
And it was impossible to have a black swan. It's like, by definition, a swan is white. Black swans aren't bad. They just happen to exist in Australia. And you just never imagined that they exist. So it's something you basically think is impossible. Like in 2008, people thought it was impossible for the U.S. housing market to collapse nationally.
Yeah, although interestingly, I think Taleb himself said that he didn't consider the housing collapse to be a black swan because he had actually thought through that scenario.
Because people had thought about it.
Some other people had attached a probability to it. But it's sort of the thinking that you only need one black swan to prove you wrong if you've made the statement all swans are white, based on your own observations, that these are things that you've never observed and so you've concluded wrongly that they can't possibly happen. Well, when it happens, that is what proves you wrong. And so in a scenario three, a planning scenario like the one you're discussing, it would be something that maybe we've had no conception of. And so it's been impossible to attach a probability to it. And so you just kind of got to like wait and see, right?
Yeah. The challenge with that is that the way we all think and behave is we have this bias towards the certain and the visible and the concrete. And so like, if I were to say to you, hey, you know, there's a chance a meteorite may hit the earth and we go into an ice age. You're like, well, what do I do with that information? It's a crazy uncertain. And so in your mind, you zero it out. It goes to zero. And that's what we do with uncertainty. When we can't get our minds around it, we essentially discount it to none. And then as a result, it's underpriced, it's underweighted. And then if you anticipate something, actually a lot of times like Y2K, people expected it and maybe prepared for it. Maybe that's why it wasn't a big deal. If you have no idea it's coming, it actually makes it worse. So yeah, this is the hardest scenario. You sort of have to say like, well, what do people think is impossible? Is nuclear war impossible? Could we have interest rates at 10%?
Do you want to dare the macroeconomy to offer you interest rates at 10%? I don't.
It's hard to imagine because you'd think there'd be a deep recession and then you end up with lower interest rates and lower inflation again.
You've described yourself, though, as a kind of an inherent downsider. You're always defaulting to the worst case scenario. But it should be noted that this scenario 3 of the unexpected can also include positive shocks, things that really boost the economy and that improve our standard of living as well, right?
It's actually, it's ironic, right? Because I was going into this podcast preparing and I was actually had built out a positive scenario that the pandemic shocked our U.S. economy out of stagnation and that it stirred it up in a way that is causing a lot of innovation, a lot of growth. Just list a few. So Tyler Cowen, he has this book and concept called The Great Stagnation. Basically said U.S. had entered a stagnation in the 70s where it basically had declining productivity, declining measures of innovation and growth. And he's positing, like, did the pandemic end that stagnation? And some of his measures are people used to move a lot, like 20% of people used to move every year. And right before the pandemic, it had fallen to like 9%. If people aren't moving, right, there's less dynamism in the economy.
Yeah, people aren't moving to the jobs where they're great fits for. They're not trying new things, experimenting, going to new places, revitalizing new places. Yeah, it's a less dynamic environment.
I mean, you can almost imagine like historical Ellis Island, people coming to America, they're coming to make it, right? That's like a hopeful idea of moving. And since the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement, right? An enormous amount of movement, people moving way more than they ever have. And that's caused a lot of really interesting changes in the economy. A lot of people also changed jobs. It really then caused a lot of people to rethink what their job should be. And then telehealth and just the way that we think about risk-taking and our behaviors. I mean, there's so much change happening. And I just think most of that was positive, actually, economically. And I think we are going to see this massive surprise on the upside. And then Russia invades Ukraine. And then the surprise was to the downside. So it's almost like hard to come up with another surprise because that ended up being the thing no one was expecting in January 2022.
Yeah, although there could be something we're not expecting for, I don't know, September 2022 or February 2023 and so forth. Like these can keep coming just because they've been bunched together in the last couple of years doesn't mean that there can't be more. And by the way, I would add one data point to the thing that you were just describing, the trend of the economy being shocked into a certain amount of experimentation. I think a lot of this, by the way, is still unclear how it will play out. But we have seen an astonishing number of startups in the last couple of years. And this could be because there was all that fiscal stimulus. This could be because interest rates have remained low. This could be because some people lost their jobs in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic and then wanted to try striking out on their own. Whatever is the cause, it's been huge for the last couple of years. And it is, I think, more persistent than a lot of people have realized. And I think it's a real possibility that that persists. On the other hand, it is going up against these negative shocks. And we don't know how it's going to shake out exactly. And there are other areas in which we might be ending the great stagnation now. We'll know in 10 years when the data for it are a lot more solid than it is now. But a lot of what Tyler Cowen has said and some other economists suggest that the next 10 years will not quite resemble the kind of slower grinding stagnancy of the last 10 years. Good or bad, it's going to be different. That seems to be where things are headed. What do you think?
But scenario one is a stable situation, and typically stable situations engender more stability, and unstable situations engender more instability. So the problem is that the sort of the instability, it just starts self-perpetuating. For us, and I take it back to like, okay, at least Fundrise and decisions we have to make, because when you're operating, you have to be basically prepared for all three of these scenarios. You have to have a margin of safety in your investment because it has to be able to absorb the shocks. That's like simple. That's with liquidity. That's basically, managing your leverage and maturities. Why I think certain real estate is actually going to be one of the best themes or strategies in this environment and has been is essentially if you look at your options today, and this was very true in January, and it's really still true despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is that there's a lot of fear in the market because of all the, as you said, contradictions. And so there's a flight to safety, but bonds are losing value because of inflation. So that's a strange contradiction to have basically people in bonds while they're losing value because they're so concerned about the instability of the market. Then you have the stock market, which mostly suffers if inflation is persistent because their main inputs are commodities and people. So to the extent that salaries are going up and commodity prices are going up, that's going to be a problem for them because it's going to cost more to basically deliver their goods. And how much they can pass that through to the consumer, I think, is going to start becoming more and more challenging over time as the consumer basically gets eaten, just like the company's getting eaten alive by the inflation. Warren Buffett calls it a tapeworm. And you've seen stocks basically suffer as a result of that. And then real estate, the reason why real estate, I think, has been very attractive, at least a lot, we've seen tons of institutional money come into residential real estate in the Sun Belt and then last mile logistics, is that it has sort of like a little bit of the safe haven benefits of bonds because people need to live someplace. I mean, even during the pandemic, shelter was basically one of the key input goods. You see a lot of stability in the real estate, but it is basically inflation indexed. The price of real estate will go up with inflation mostly. And so it's a good hedge against inflation, while it's also a hedge against market uncertainty. So we've seen billions pour into residential real estate in the Sun Belt as a result of it being this kind of Goldilocks solution. And so you look at scenario one and say, okay, scenario one, it does pretty well. Scenario two, it's not as good as scenario one, but it's not like you're in office buildings or you're in hotels or something where basically it's like the demand for it gets crushed. Often rental real estate does better in recessions because people move out of their houses. In 2008, rents went up because people moved out of their houses into apartments.
A lot of people were losing their houses too to foreclosure.
It was
horrible.
They're not necessarily wanting to move out. So it was a good place to be in terms of protection. If the economy's roaring, you don't get as much of the upside as you would in like high tech or more of these sort of high risk investments. But if you think that's not likely, if you think basically it's going to be either like scenario one or scenario two, we didn't do a scenario where everything's roaring, everything's great. You'd be in a different kind of real estate for sure.
Also, when everything's going great, who cares? Nobody complains and you don't really have to worry too much about the world as much when everything's just going fantastically well. So it is more interesting think through the calamitous events. And also, I think it's more important too, if that makes sense. A really healthy, strong, growing economy tends to kind of wash away a lot of that stuff.
But we have 250,000 investors. And so a lot of our investors were making 30, 40% returns in 2019 or 2020 or whatever it was. And they're like, why aren't you doing as well as that? And we did pretty well last year, but generally the ups on real estate won't be as high as the ups on high risk equities. And we got a decent amount of grief about that, but it's just not the nature of the product, but okay.
Uh-huh. My follow-up question to the scenario that you just laid out where real estate can be quite resilient to some of these trends is that it seems like there are still a couple of risks. One is just that if inflation is persistently high, that eventually interest rates will follow as they tend to, and they'll also be higher. And that means higher mortgage rates and then less demand for real estate. The other risk, though, is one that I think still depends on a lot of variables that are in flux, which is that, there are a lot of people fed up with the high cost of housing right now. And I think in some cities and even in some states, you're starting to see a lot of pushback on the kind of zoning laws that restrict the building of more real estate. And so if that changes, you might see more building, and that might also be something that restrains price growth. And that has winners and losers. If you are a homeowner and your home is your primary savings asset, that can be bad. If you're somebody who either wants to buy a first-time house or if you're somebody who just wants to move somewhere else, it's better for there to be more building. But in terms of how it affects prices, that seems like it's a risk also. So do you want to kind of address like those two risks for you?
Those are two great points. So let's do the first one, which is high interest rates, high inflation. So the, let's just take an example period, 1970 to 1980. So 1970 was the beginning of a 10-year period where interest rates went from low to very, very high. It was the most inflationary period in the history of America. I remember my father actually was in real estate then. He said he locked in a 10-year loan in 1980, early 80s at 22%.
Oh my God.
So prime.
You think mortgage rates are going up in the last year to over 4% or something. Things were a lot worse back then, sure.
So you're talking about going from, I don't remember where it started, 3%, 4%, 5% to 20% in that decade. That's what you're describing, kind of a worst case scenario. So what happened in the 70s to the stock market from 1970 to 1980, if you put in $100 in 1970, 10 years later, you had $68. It went down 10 years later, yeah. Right? That's something that people have never experienced. And most of our people alive who are investing in stock market haven't experienced a decline that persists for over 10 years. That's what inflation did to stocks. And you can say the stock market's changed and it's less capital intensive, et cetera, but it tells you something. Real estate, take home prices. From 1970, 1980, home prices tripled because essentially the cost of construction, the cost of goods went up so much and real estate basically picked that up. So despite the fact that interest rates went up so much and you're paying much higher interest, still you're overall way better in real estate than in stocks. Obviously, you'd rather have what we have had, which is low interest rates and high inflation. That's just an incredible combination. It's great for real estate because you get like all the rent growth, but you're borrowing at a low rate. That's what we've had last year. And then the second scenario, which is basically like a regulatory risk. So we operate mostly in the Sun Belt. We have some real estate and operations in some of the sort of bigger, what used to be called the gateway cities. They were like the cities where all the institutional money went, LA, New York, San Francisco, Chicago. But we mostly invested away from those cities. We thought those cities were overpriced. And it's getting more and more difficult to do anything in the city. There's not likely to be much new supply. It's actually incredibly hard to get anything built. We have stuff under construction. And it's really surprising. So you have to see either oversupply in the Sun Belt. I think there's going to be a lot more supply, but what we're mostly seeing today, and I think we're going to see for some time to come, is that you're so supply chain constrained, we can't get hinges for doors. We can't get refrigerators. We can't get stoves. You can't get labor. And then when you do, we bought thousands of homes and apartment units last year, thousands, like maybe 5,000 units. And the home we bought cost us $150 a square foot. And today, you could not build a home for $150 a square foot. It's going to cost you $175. And I bet you next year costs you $200. And so as long as the new supply is coming in and it's more expensive to build than the old supply, up to a point, it's just not a risk. I think it's a benefit. We saw that in the last 20 years, that growth drives more growth, more people moving, more new businesses, more new coffee shops, and that's happening across the Sun Belt, across Austin and Tampa and Orlando and Atlanta and Charlotte. So there's a virtuous cycle happening there. So I don't see the new supply as a problem. I see it as mostly a benefit.
All right. Well, we've talked about the U.S. economy, the global economy, geopolitical events, planning for the future, three different scenarios, a discussion of risks in the housing market. It has been quite an indulgent feast, I think. Just to wrap things up, do you want to offer any closing thoughts?
Well, here we are having to operate with these very extreme possibilities and still do well. So we're really looking forward to the next podcast.
Oh, you want to tease that one?
Yeah. Our thing is to talk a little bit about the company because we have a lot of investors, not just in the real estate on our platform, but also in the company itself. We democratized investing not just into real assets, but also into our company. Like the way Vanguard's owned by its customers, we're also owned by our customers. And so we would love to do an in-depth about sort of what's happening with us and where we are going.
All right. Excellent. Something for listeners to look forward to. Thanks to listeners for subscribing and tell everybody about it. And yeah, Ben, we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thanks a lot, Carter.
Again, I have been your host, Cardiff Garcia, and I was here with Ben Miller, Fundrise CEO and co-host. Thanks so much for listening, and please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you liked what you heard, please also rate us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. This year's podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did the music, and by Bazaar Audio, from me and co-founder Amy Keene. And we'll see you again next month. Bye now.